Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
As you know, Walter Mondale died Monday, April 19th, and I find myself just very sad that Fritz is no longer here. A truly wonderful man and a very good friend to all his friends and to me. He helped me when very few people thought I could win, and he stood by me when some others walked away. Fritz and I sat down in his office in August of 2019 for this podcast, and I thought I'd replay it for you. You know, it's funny. His Christmas card to me and Franny somehow got held up, and we only got it just last week. And in very strong hand, he wrote, "Dear Al and Franny, I miss you." Well, I miss him. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Vice President Walter Mondale. Again, this was an interview that we did in his office on August 19th of 2019. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Vice President Walter Mondale is my guest here, and we're recording in his office. He works at a law firm here in Minneapolis, and so we're doing that. So you may hear interruptions. He is just beloved here in Minnesota, and for a reason. He is 91 years old now and has served the state. He served the state for a really long time, and this country. He was in the Senate at a time when it was working better than it does now. Let's just put it that way. A lot of it, I think, has to do with what happened during the period that he was there, and specifically the Civil Rights Bill. Before the Civil Rights Bill, we had a Democratic Party that was liberal and progressive and conservative. And the Republican Party was conservative And then it had these Northeastern Republicans who were liberal and progressive. So what happened to get anything done, you had to work across party lines. And that doesn't happen now. And that is a shame. So when Fritz Mondale was there, he got stuff done. He got a equal housing bill done, civil rights bill, and of course, Vice President of the United States. He really created the modern vice presidency. Until then, really, the vice president was just there in case the president died. And presidents used to die pretty often. So you had that. I believe he was the first vice president to have his office in the White House, in the West Wing, near the Oval Office, by the Oval Office, and not in the executive office building across the street. And really invented, he and Carter worked together. They did not fire a shot during their 4 years. You're 91 now?
That's the last I heard.
You know, I was thinking, run for president.
Yes.
And it'll just make the other guys look younger.
Well, yes, but 91's not too old to run, is it?
How old was Adenauer when he retired?
90.
90.
But I think he was 90, but he was older.
Adenauer was the chancellor of Germany for years. And was close to 90. It all depends how you're doing when you're 90, isn't it?
I have the opinion that maybe it's a little old.
Now, you teach the presidency and the law.
And the Constitution.
And the Constitution.
At the Humphrey School.
The Humphrey School. Yeah. Let me ask you something, because it came up. Can the president order companies to leave a country like China?
I don't think so. We're a free society. People are free to do what they want, say what they want, unless they collide with the law. And I don't know. He's citing some law that doesn't seem to fit at all about extremism or terrorism and when that can be stopped. But no, I don't think he's making sense here at all.
I don't think so either, and it's not unusual.
No, he does it every day.
Yeah, and it's hard to keep track of.
I used to think that I could, but you can't. Every day is different. Last couple of days, he's both said we got to go easier on the China trade thing, and then said, "Oh no, he's going to be tougher." All within 24 hours. So be my guest.
Yeah, he increased the tariffs, gets to the G7, says, someone asked him, do you have regrets? He said, of course I have regrets. I have regrets all the time. And he says, I'm going to lower them. And then his team says, no, he didn't mean that. And then they said he means he's going to raise them. And then he said he's going to raise them. They got the message to him. I think a lot of Americans have this experience, which is you try to collect or remember so that you can organize them all the unbelievably horrible things he's done.
Yep.
And you can't. I think that's part of his defense.
He lies all the time. Doesn't seem to bother him. He lies several times a day. He has this thing about dividing people, splitting the country up, getting people fighting. That seems to be what he wants to do every day. And he's getting it done, and we're all paying a price for it. He's over there in Europe stomping around. You know, those are important meetings. This is where an American leader and all former presidents since that institution was created saw it as a time to try to bring the Western world together and demonstrate the United States' ability to listen and work with others. He has none of that in him, as far as I can see.
You two are very different.
Who? I hope so.
I think you're the opposite. Okay, the opposite of black is white. The opposite of Trump, is there such a thing? But if there is, it's kind of you. You have always worked to bring people together. You've stood for things like civil rights. And I want to talk about the Civil Rights Bill and Hubert Humphrey and your work with him and with Lyndon Johnson on that bill and bills that followed, like on housing and such. I was thinking about the 1964 Civil Rights Bill as a demarcation in our country's politics. Because before that, the South had been Democratic since the Civil War. And once the Civil Rights Bill happened, and we got the Southern Strategy, and it became Republican.
That's right.
Took a while, but now it's just...
Didn't take very long.
No. Yeah. No, it didn't. And you were there then. So I want to ask you about how long it took and how quickly you thought things changed. Because before it, you had very conservative Democrats in the South. You had Richard Russell. You had...
Yes.
And you had... very liberal Republicans in the Northeast.
That's right.
You had Jacob Javits. And
we had several of those moderates in Northeastern United States Republicans that we worked with on almost everything, including civil rights.
So pretty much things got done because you had to work in a bipartisan way. That's just because of the structure of the two parties.
And then we had the votes when issues came up. In those days, you had to get 67 votes to close off.
That's right. They changed the number.
67. So it's almost they set the rule up so it'd be impossible. And we got enough senators, Republicans and Democrats, to ride over those rules. And it was a great time in, I think, America's history. And I loved it, of course, because there had been... one way or another, 200 years of paralysis on civil rights. And suddenly the dam broke, and we charted a new course for our country. And I think we've been better off as a nation ever since. Not perfect, for sure, but progress.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, it's almost silly to question that. I was born in 1951. I grew up in St. Louis Park, middle class. Dad was a printing salesman. Dad didn't graduate high school. I was the luckiest kid in the world.
Yep. Happy guy, weren't you? This is good
I was
day.
Very happy.
Yep.
Our school system, St. Louis Park school system, one of the best in the state, or maybe the best. And I just knew I could do anything. And this is post-World War II.
Yep.
Who said this? Rick Nolan, I think.
Yeah.
He said that you had to have a plan to fail in post-World War II. If you were white.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the Civil Rights Bill and because of the progress since then, that's less true.
Yeah. We put aside maybe the most disgraceful element in American life, and that is that we were willing to put blacks and minorities down. We were willing to put women in secondary roles. We were willing to let the white males stride around uninterrupted in any way. Being a white male, I know what that's like, but...
That's terrible, huh?
Well, yeah. Well, you know, that's what you get used to when you're a kid. It goes your way. But that's not the way it should be in America. We should be using everybody, listening to everybody, male, female, minority, whites, to shape our policies and bring us together and get things done.
It's actually...
Now we can do that. We haven't done it yet as much as we should, but we can do
we
it.
We certainly haven't done it yet. There's certainly... The disparities actually are getting wider and wider because people at the very top are getting wealthier. The rest of America is not progressing, and the people at the bottom, it's in many ways getting worse. And the legacy of slavery did not go away in 1865, and it continued.
I think that's right, but this phenomenon of millions of Americans slipping who had been middle-class Americans has been a phenomenon of the last 20 years. We've had it before in American life. Terrible thing where people of wealth and influence squeeze everybody out of the mainstream of American life. And that's what we've been having, I think.
Yeah, we had that last part of the 19th century, and we're seeing it now. Talking about 1964 and the Civil Rights Bill, and then the Republican Party just becoming the Conservative Party, and are becoming a progressive party. And man, there's no working together. And we have a president who is doing everything he can to double down every chance he can to divide people. And I guess that's his strategy. That's how he won last time. And that must be his strategy again, because I don't see any
it must
change.
Be, but I don't get it. I mean, if he wanted to be a successful public leader, he would do just the opposite. He'd try to pull us together.
It depends what you consider success, I guess.
Well, I will never accept his model as either being successful or worthy of success, or never should be attributed or accepted as morally acceptable.
I don't think it is.
No.
Well, I mean, it obviously is by people who vote for him. People say, oh, he's just, they all lie. All people in public life lie, all politicians. And he's at least being honest about lying.
I ran into a guy the other day say, well, at least he's doing what he promised.
Wow.
I said, that's exactly what he's not doing.
Yeah.
In the campaign, he's forgotten all his promises.
He was going to help working people. That's what all the focus was. And that's why he won Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin.
He thought, here's the guy that'll do it. Yep.
And all the people in Washington are self-serving, and they're just, it's all rigged. That was what we heard in that election. It's rigged, it's rigged, it's rigged.
You're going to drain the swamp.
Yeah, drain the swamp. And what we have is what we have.
Is the swamp.
Is just creatures that we've never seen before doing things that you want to avert your eyes to what they're doing.
Yep.
And this isn't about sex.
Nope.
It's about stealing. it's about hurting people.
It's about gross immorality. In our society, people that work and try surely are owed respect, and they're owed a chance to be a part of middle-class America. He's taken that from them. And I don't know what he thinks he's doing, but I'm appalled by it.
Well, we saw this huge tax cut, very antithetical to his goals, his stated goals.
Announced goals, yeah.
And that's
right. He knew what he was doing. This was a typical right-wing Republican payoff to the rich.
Exactly.
We've seen that before.
And now what we are seeing are these enormous deficits.
Yep.
And
we're talking about $1 trillion next year.
That's right.
Get that, $1 trillion.
Just the deficit next year.
Yes. So this society is going to be paying off debt for eons.
You know how my Republican colleagues,
yep,
when Obama was president, They would all, and you had a piece of legislation, it would always go, what's the pay for?
We've heard nothing but debt scares when Democrats want to do something. And along came this massive tax cut bill that you've talked about, where all the money goes to the rich. And the Republicans didn't say a thing. They didn't criticize it, didn't talk about deficit scares. If they did, they said, well, this will pay for itself, so you don't have to worry
about it. Oh, yeah. When they addressed it, it was dynamic scoring.
Yep. And in fact, we've been through this several times. It never pays for itself.
Well, they always use dynamic scoring.
Yes, that's right.
Dynamic scoring is this magical thing where if you cut taxes, it'll increase economic activity. And what happened was these corporations bought back their stocks.
That's right.
Their stock. Mm-hmm. So.
And did well by themselves for themselves.
Right. You study history. Is there another president we can point to? I don't know all, 45?
No.
I mean, is it?
We've never had a president. Now, maybe you go back 100 years or more. I'm younger than 100 years old.
Slightly.
Yes. We've always believed our public leaders should be honest and law-abiding and...
Well, I mean, some weren't. Nixon wasn't. Harding wasn't.
Yeah, and Nixon got in real trouble because of that.
He had to leave.
Nixon had good people around him. He had some really able people like Jim Baker and so on. This guy has nobody. He doesn't talk to anybody as far as I can see.
No, I mean, I don't want to sing Nixon's praises.
Nope.
But he seemed to be serious about foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
And was a disaster in what he did in Vietnam. And that's, I think, that Humphrey
agreed
would have done it very differently. Yeah. You saw that very closely, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Humphrey would have gone at it far differently.
And so he got this nomination in 64 to be vice president. You had to handle the Mississippi Freedom Caucus or delegation. And that must have been a lot of pressure on you. Just why don't we set that up? Because that was a...
I'd like to talk about that because it's one of the things in my long career that I find is subject to criticism, and maybe properly so, but we were trying to get through that convention, elect Johnson and Humphrey, so that we could move forward on civil rights. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party were made of fine people, but they wanted everything solved right now with no regard for the broader picture. We won. We controlled that convention. And then we delivered on what we promised to do. And when the next convention came around, all these Freedom Democrats were sitting in the front row as Democratic Party delegates.
Just to frame it for people.
Including Fannie Lou Hamer. And so I think if you give us just a few years to work it out, I think we look pretty good.
Just to frame it. In 1964, basically the Mississippi Democratic Party didn't allow blacks to vote
in the delegation process. The Democratic Party of Mississippi was devoted to being against civil rights. They didn't have a single black delegate in amongst the whites. Most of them wouldn't say they'll vote for the Democratic candidate.
And they didn't.
One of the reasons Carter gained stature and could become president was how he managed to defeat Wallace in Florida. In the previous 4 years, Wallace, he did everything he could to cripple the Democratic Party. But Jimmy Carter challenged him in Florida in the next primaries, and beat him big time. So that people felt good about that. I did.
And Carter was the New South.
Yeah.
Emblematic of the New South. Well, let's talk about your relationship with Jimmy Carter. You really, the two of you, took two to do this, invented the modern vice presidency.
Mm-hmm.
And some modern vice presidents haven't participated in that. I think of Dan Quayle,
yeah.
Probably was not George H.W. Bush's closest advisor.
No. But I think that after Carter broke the tradition there of just using a vice president as standby equipment and instead bringing him in to the complete work of the president himself, locating the vice president in the president's office, that changed things. Not just for us, but here we are 50 years later, and that's still what's happening.
I mean, not now. I don't think that, well, Trump is an anomaly in so many ways, but the idea that he is conferring with Pence is ridiculous.
Right. Well, here's the thing. Pence is in the White House. What he's doing there, I don't know. I keep telling them not to just stand behind the president. Go out and do your own thing and help the president, but don't just think that you've got a chore there to be standing at attention when your president talks. Look at this guy. That's all he does. He walks up behind the president, stands at attention. The president gives these...
There's a creepiness to all of it.
Yeah, what's he thinking? What's he doing?
And he contributes to the creepiness, I would say.
I think so.
Yeah. Quayle was creepy in his own way, but Trump is creepy in a way where the anxiety level in the country has been raised because of this president.
Right.
And it's not irrational from people. This is people looking at this guy and taking him seriously. Remember, I think Republicans said, don't take him literally, take him seriously. What we're taking seriously is this guy is, there are people who diagnose. I don't believe diagnosing people that you haven't actually talked to and examined.
Yeah, I don't. I hear
accepted
that.
Practice. Yeah. But Jesus, there's something wrong with him.
Let me say right away, I do not know. I'm not saying there is anything, but he is breaking all the rules. He doesn't ever ponder about what he said 2 minutes before. He started this whole tweet stuff that is new to him. Just think, running our country, maybe from his bedroom or from a radio room.
Fritz, you can tweet from anywhere.
Huh? Yeah.
If you got a signal,
Yeah. I just don't understand. The public doesn't like it.
I think on the one hand, you can say that it's not fair to diagnose someone if you haven't talked to them and are a psychiatrist. But people also know what they see.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after the massacres in Dayton and El Paso, the president gave a speech. He did this speech it was as if it was the first time he had read it.
Could be true.
This is a moment where the president fulfills a role, or should fulfill a role, that no one else in the country can fill. When there is a tragedy like a massacre, which we see too many times,
yep.
I felt like he has a special obligation to speak to the nation. He's the one person who can speak to the nation and make us at least feel like we're a nation that is grieving for all these people. And in a way that just reassures people that we're good.
And that we intend to do good. We're going to try to do good.
And that we are human, that we care, we have compassion, we grieve.
Yes, yes.
We grieve. And I saw this speech, and it was like his head was on a swivel. Remember, he used to criticize Obama for using a teleprompter, of course, and now he uses it all the time. It was just, I'll go to the left teleprompter for this, then I'll turn to the right, and I'll just say these words. And someone wrote the words, and I don't remember any of the words, but what I do remember was his affect. And to me, if I were to give him advice, it would be read the speech beforehand several times, absorb it, rewrite it yourself. So they're your words, some of them.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, but I may be wrong, but I don't think he takes advice.
No. But is there a difference between taking advice and taking help? I mean, the State of the Union address is not written by Donald Trump.
No.
I mean, that's clear. So he needs help there. He obviously doesn't need help to go in front of 15, 20,000 people and talk off the top of his head for an hour or an hour and a half. And that's a skill, and that is a skill that got him elected president.
That's right. And although he says outrageous things, he's good at it.
Yep.
He raises these audiences. He gets them excited. He pumps them up.
They laugh at his jokes.
Yep.
He's like a comedian who goes in front of a crowd and works them, and he listens, and he finds out what hits, what works.
And he uses it.
So I'm going to build a wall, and Mexico is going to pay for it. I'm going to put that in. The first time he did it.
So he kept doing it. Yep.
And so he shut the government down because that bit went over.
Yeah.
That hunk.
Yeah. That's true.
I called you his opposite. But in a way, there's some similarities. You grew up very wealthy, right?
Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. And
5 cents.
And then took advantage of that wealth by cheating on the inheritance of it.
Yeah. Well, if I could just emphasize the point you made. I grew up in Ceylon and then Elmore, Minnesota. These are small towns. I mean, really small, basically farm communities. And I went through high school in Elmore. And I loved it. We were kids. We were in small towns. Perfect. And I'm really glad I grew up there. And then we were encouraged by our families to not just...
Now, your dad is a minister, right?
He's a minister. And he had a vision that he should go out and be a minister. And he went around, the Lutherans wouldn't have him because he didn't have the right credentials, didn't have any credentials.
Mm-hmm.
But the Methodists took him as a kind of a lay pastor. And for most of his career, that's what he did. He was a preacher in small rural towns along the southern border and over near
Near Iowa,
yeah.
That southern border of Minnesota.
He loved doing that.
But that sounds like a big wealth generator.
Oh.
We
never had anything, and nobody needed anything. We were just...
You were growing up in a small town.
Yep.
You
We had a they call a parsonage, which is a house provided by the church for the minister, which was not exactly ready for habitation. But we lived there. And I used to be the janitor for the church. And then I would go to school, and we had a football and a basketball team.
You were Crazy Legs, right?
Yeah, and we had a track team, and there wasn't much, but we thought we were pretty good.
Let's see, other ways in which you're opposite. You went to law school.
I'm always glad that I became a lawyer. I mean, most people have negative feelings about lawyers, and they're not all perfect, but this allowed me to be a public servant and begin with our commitment to the law, to the Constitution. And all through my public life, that was sort of where I'd start things. And that's one of the things that really offends me about the current president. I don't think he knows a thing about it and wants to know a thing about it. And yet the law, the Constitution, lays down the guidelines for our essential behavior as citizens.
Wait a minute. Is that what it is?
Yes. That's what it is.
Man, I wish I knew that when I was in the Senate.
Yeah, you should have been thinking about that.
Yeah.
Well, didn't you find that the law and the Constitution are very important to your service in the Senate?
I did, and I was on judiciary, on the Judiciary Committee. Yep. I was one of the few non-lawyers there.
Yep.
But I felt that I had some skills that some of my colleagues didn't have.
Yeah, and you had some guts.
That was one of the skills.
Yeah, but I think that in order to be a good public servant, you have to have a good mind, you have to think things through, then you have to have courage, you have to stand up and confront issues. That's what you did.
You know what you have to do, too? You find issues.
Yeah.
And I found issues like mandatory arbitration.
Yeah.
That was a battle against large corporations, and I did that in terms of consolidation of media, and those are some of the fights I picked. But one thing I did was I would meet with my judiciary counsel if there was a hearing the next day, at the end of the day, before I went home. And they would give me the briefing book. Did you get your binders at the end of the day for hearings?
I don't think we had those. We had some briefing papers, but I don't remember.
I used to get the testimony.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure they do. That's what you do. You get a binder with the testimony.
Yeah.
The witnesses are required or told, some don't do this, to have their testimony in so that we can take it home and read it.
Right.
And then my staff will have read it, my judiciary staff, and they will tell me what I'm going to read, and they will tell me, they all have fashioned questions, and I'll ask questions about the questions, but I hadn't read the testimony yet. Then I'd go home, and I'd read the binder, and then I'd call them like at 10 p.m., and I'd say, what if we did this or this or this, and let's rewrite this way, or let's, you know, I noticed something. I noticed something here. In a footnote, this guy says that some study said that heterosexual married couples do better than same-sex couples when it comes to their children's performance in school or something like that. And it cites a study. And so can we look at that? And then they would look at it, and it wouldn't say what the guy said it said. And I could bring it up, there you go. And so you do the work.
Yeah.
That's what we're saying,
and
right?
Because you want to. You get into issues. You told that story about the footnote. There was something he said that you thought was wrong, and you wanted to correct it, and you wanted to make that a public point in the following day.
Yep.
And that's what I
And that's an opportunity.
Yeah, you get into things you feel deeply about it and you go for it. Yep.
Yeah, and I miss that.
Oh, yeah.
Man. I do. You know, I think there actually also is, on judiciary especially, I felt it, but in other committees too, is having been a performer helps.
Yep.
I mean, I would send my colleagues, well, one colleague in particular on judiciary, questions for Kavanaugh and questions for Barr.
He's a beauty.
Unbelievable.
Yep. Where'd they find him?
He had been Attorney General before, and he was some corporate, you know. Mm-hmm. He was making a lot of money, and now he wanted to come in. And basically, that hearing should have been about the things he said before the report came out.
Yeah.
And the things he said before the report came out were just lies. And he knew that the American people, no one is going to read a 450-page report. They're just not. So he goes there and said, it concluded that the president cooperated with the investigation.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, I like wrote my colleague, I said, just say, okay, he fired the first head of the investigation.
Right.
He then ordered his legal counsel to order the deputy attorney general to fire you. Mm-hmm. This is in testimony to talking to Mueller.
Right.
And then he ordered his legal counsel to write a memo saying that he hadn't told him to do that. And he kept directing Sessions to fire Mueller.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't submit to interviews.
Yeah.
The point is, I would have asked.
Sure.
I would have said, the people of Minnesota don't consider firing the first head of the investigation, ordering your subordinates to fire the next head of the investigation to be cooperating.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
This is frustrating.
Yes, it is. But you're going to find a way of doing it, I think.
Yeah. There's a phrase called the wit of the staircase, and it's French. Yeah. And I don't speak French. And I suffer from it all the time. I went, damn, I wish I had said this in the hearing or something. Did you have any of those in your career?
Oh, yeah. You know, a lot of times you don't have time to other people are speaking. You can't get in there. Sometimes you've already made another point, and it's not appropriate for you to try to hog the stage. You often get in a position where you haven't quite done all you wanted to do.
You just don't think of the thing that later you think of.
That's right.
That's all.
That's right.
That's all we're talking about.
Yeah.
I remember the first debate against Reagan, your first debate against Reagan in 84, he started to kind of talk about driving up the Pacific Coast Highway, and it kind of wandered nowhere. What was the question? Do you remember at all?
Well, he brought it up. This was a standard speech he gave about what should be important to America or to California, and what he wanted to put in the memory files.
Like a time capsule?
That was it. Okay. So 100 years from now, this would be him talking to the...
So this was a standard speech he had.
Yes.
Which is, I'm driving down the Pacific
Coast Highway. Then he got in the middle of it and couldn't remember. Afterwards, one of the reporters on the panel said, you know, you made a bad mistake here. He said, when Reagan's time was up, you should have said, no, I'm interested in this, and I cede my time to the president, because he said he didn't know where he was.
Yeah. Now, did that guy tell you that immediately after?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then he starts the next debate with, I'm not going to hold your youth and inexperience.
That's right.
And have you ever thought about that moment?
Yes. I think about it all the time.
Okay, that's what I...
Because
okay.
I thought it was ridiculous because I was 55. I wasn't a baby. And he was, what, 70 or something like that? And I hadn't raised a point. So I didn't give it the seriousness that...
Everyone was wondering after that moment in the first debate whether he
was losing.
That's
right.
So they had
to find some way of getting back on the program.
Of defusing that.
Yeah. And it was a clever thing, and he handled it very well. But I didn't recognize how important that was going to be in the rest of the campaign, because this kind of told the public that, yes, the president was with it. He knew what he was doing.
And he could deliver a line that someone had written for him.
This was a sense of humor he'd used, and that he took me out on that issue. I don't think any of that was true, but that's the way it was taken. He was, at that point, the oldest president in American history, I believe.
And obviously he was beginning, I think.
I think that there was something going on there. I never said that in the campaign because I didn't know and I couldn't prove it. But I think he was starting to slip.
Let's talk about losing or suffering a setback.
Mm-hmm.
Something I'm kind of sensitive
to
myself.
You're getting to be an expert on this. Well...
And resilience. And the bastard came to Minnesota and tried to win Minnesota, too.
Well, that's legal.
It's legal, but, you know, you'd think...
By then he knew he had destroyed me, and he was going to win big, and of course he did. What hurt... I guess after the campaign, I would sit there and try to figure out what happened. Why couldn't I have thought these things through? Why did I get so tired when these things came up? And I found that I couldn't sleep at night, so I just had a bunch of books next to my bed, and I'd read for 3 hours or 4 hours and go take a nap and wake up at 4 in the morning and start reading again. And for the better part of a month, that's the life I lived. I just couldn't.
Just a month.
I just couldn't get.
Just a month.
Well, it was longer than a month, but the full night deal was a month. And I would say for a couple of months after that, I was sleeping a little bit better, but still less than a full night. And boy, did I get tired and disoriented.
Mm-hmm.
And then slowly I started feeling better, starting to get better sleep, and I went back to get involved in politics in my own way. I made arrangements to come home, which is what I always wanted to do, and so on.
And then, of course, ambassador to Japan. How long were you in Japan?
Just under 4 years. Yeah, I loved that.
Yeah.
Joan loved it.
Joan pretty much overshadowed you in Japan, didn't
well,
she?
Well, a lot of people are saying that I...
She was beloved.
Yeah, no one said that about me. And I remember we had our farewell reception, about 600 people there, and at least 400, maybe 500 were there to say goodbye to Joan. And my staff was there to say goodbye to me.
Well, and people should understand, listeners should understand, Joan was about the arts.
Yes. And she loved to pot, and the Japanese loved pottery. And wherever she'd go, if they wanted to, she'd sit down and throw pots with them. And they loved that. I mean, that's still hear about that. And she always hands out a little piece of pottery as a gift. She never sold anything. And there's a little thing called a guanomi that she would do, and she'd hand it. People love it. I'll bet you on shelves all over Japan, there's little guanomis.
Now, what does a guanomi hold?
It holds maybe some salt or some pepper. It's not very deep.
Okay.
This,
by the way, is an audio medium. So when you go, it's just like this.
Yes, it's like this. Can they see it better now?
Yeah, he held it closer to the mic, ladies and gentlemen. It's a small thing.
You said in the notes that you'd like to talk about Minnesota.
Yeah.
What a good state it is. One of the things that's slowly dawning on me as I get into these old years is indeed what a wonderful state it is. I mean, a lot of nice people here. People are trying to make things work. There's a decency to Minnesota life. When we have an election, more people vote in Minnesota than any other state in the union. We take our politics seriously. We have good office holders. You were an excellent example.
Thank you.
Governor, Tim Walz, and the people in the state, they're wonderful people. All across the board, we see that. And I just think Minnesotans should feel good about that and build on it and continue to try to be the wonderful state that we hope it is. I don't think I can claim to be an expert on much, but I'm an expert on Minnesota. I've been everywhere all the time for all those years in Washington, here and here, wherever. And I've come to really love this state, and I like being around it, and I like talking to Minnesotans.
I love it, too, and Minnesotans, there's a lot of things that you talked about, including just the involvement in voting.
Yeah, yeah.
People care. There's a thing called Minnesota Nice. Now, sometimes, you know, that can be a little passive-aggressive.
Yeah, I know. We're not saps. In other words, if something has to be said, we want to hear it.
But this is an unbelievably great place to live.
Yeah.
And we also have brought in Hmong refugees.
Yep.
And we've brought in Somali refugees.
Right.
And they are adding so much to our
and
state.
And we're becoming somewhat different and better, I think, as a result.
Absolutely. And I know you got to go. You got to do something. So, and you don't have to tell us what it is. I don't know.
I want to tell you what it is.
Okay.
I have what I call a Mondale lunch every week or every 2 weeks where I get as many of my kids and grandchildren who will come. And we have a lunch, and we talk about things, sometimes we talk about nothing. And it's the high point of my life, because it's a way of staying close to my family. I love it.
Well, I'm going to keep you from that.
Oh, good.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. I just can't tell you how appreciative I am of your time and your friendship and your counsel and support. You probably love this state because the state loves you.
Well, I enjoyed working with you. I admire the depth and decency of your public service. And as I said to you a lot of time, probably I hope we can find a way to continue that. You're needed here.
Well, thank you. We'll cut that out.
People want to leave it in there. People want you.
Okay.
Thank you
very
much.
I'll let you go.
Thank you.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me,
DJ Fu,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat.
Yeah.
Wondry and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondry app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondry Plus in the Wondry app or Wondry Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Once Upon a Beat.